I'm reading from Irving Goffman's Frame Analysis, an essay on the organization experience. Chapter 2, Primary Framework. When the individual in our Western society recognizes a particular event, he tends, whatever else he does, to imply in this response, and in effect employ, one or more frameworks or schemata of interpretation of a kind that can be called primary. I say primary because application of such a framework or perspective is seen by those who apply it as not depending on or harking back to some prior or original interpretation. Indeed, a primary framework is one that is seen as rendering what would otherwise be a meaningless aspect of the scene into something that is meaningful. Primary frameworks vary in degree of organization. Some are neatly presentable as a system of entities, postulates, and rules. Others, indeed most others, appear to have no apparent articulated shape, providing only a lore of understanding, an approach, a perspective. Whatever the degree of organization, however, each primary framework allows its user to locate, perceive, identify, and label a seemingly infinite number of concrete occurrences defined in its terms. He is likely to be unaware of such organized features the framework has, and unable to describe the framework with any completeness if asked, yet these handicaps are no bar to his easily and fully applying it. In daily life in our society, a tolerably clear distinction is sensed, if not made, between two broad classes of primary framework, natural and social. Natural frameworks identify occurrences seen as undirected, unoriented, unanimated, unguided, purely physical. Such unguided events are ones understood to be totally, from start to finish, to natural determinant. It is seen that no willful agency causally and intentionally interferes, that no actor continuously guides the outcome. Success or failure in regard to these events is not imaginable. No negative or positive sanctions are involved. Full determinism and determinant prevail. There is some understanding that events perceived in one such schema can be reductively translated into ones perceived in a more fundamental framework, and that some premises, such as the notion of the conservation of energy, or that of a single irreversible time, will be shared by all. Elegant versions of these natural frameworks are found, of course, in the physical and biological science. An ordinary example would be the state of the weather as given in a report. Social frameworks, on the other hand, provide background understanding for events that incorporate the will, aim, and controlling effort of an intelligence, a live agency, the chief one being the human being. Such an agency is anything but implacable. It can be coaxed, flattered, affronted, and threatened. What it does can be described as guided doing. These doings subject the doer to standard, to social appraisal of his action based on its honesty, efficiency, economy, safety, elegance, tactfulness, good taste, and so forth. A serial management of consequentiality is sustained, that is, continuous corrective control, becoming most apparent when action is unexpectedly blocked or deflected, and special compensatory effort is required. Motive and intent are involved, and their imputation helps select which of the various social frameworks of understanding is to be applied. An example of a guided doing would be the newscast reporting of the weather. So one deals here with deed, not merely event. We use the same term, causality, to refer to the blind effect of nature and the intended effect of man, the first seen as an infinitely extended chain of caused and causing event, and the second something that somehow begins with a mental decision. In our society, we feel that intelligent agents have the capacity to gear into the ongoing natural world and exploit its determinants, providing only that natural design is respected. Moreover, it is felt that, with the possible exception of pure fantasy or thought, whatever an agent seeks to do will be continuously conditioned by natural constraint, and that effective doing will require the exploitation, not the neglect, of this condition. Even when two persons playing checkers by keeping the board in their heads, they will still have to convey information concerning move, this exchange requiring physically competent, willful use of the voice in speech or the hand in writing. The assumption is, then, that although natural events occur without intelligent intervention, intelligent doings cannot be accomplished effectively without entrance into the natural order. Thus, any segment of a socially guided doing can be partly analyzed within a natural schema. Guided doings appear then to allow for two kinds of understanding. One, more or less common to all doing, pertains to the patent manipulation of the natural world in accordance with the special constraints that natural occurrings impose. The other understanding pertains to the special worlds in which the actor can become involved, which of course vary considerably. Thus, each play in checkers involves two radically different bases for guidance. One pertains to quite physical matters, to the physical management of the vehicle, not the sign. The other pertains to the very social world of opposing positions that the play has generated, wherein a move can equally well be made by voice, gesture, or the male, or by physically shifting a checker by the fist, any combination of fingers, or the right elbow. Behavior at the board can easily be separated into making moves and shifting checkers, and an easy distinction can be drawn between a clumsy move, one that ill considers the strategic positions of the two players, and a move made clumsily, one that has been badly executed according to local social standards for accomplishing physical act. Observe that although an adult with a newly acquired prosthetic device might play checkers fully mindfully of the physical task involved, ordinary players do not. Decisions as to which move to make are problematic and significant. Pushing the checker once the decision is made is neither. On the one hand, there are guided doings such as fixing the sink or clearing a sidewalk in which sustained conscious effort is given to manipulating the physical world, the doing itself taking on the identity of an instrumental procedure, a task, a purely utilitarian activity, a doing the purpose of which cannot be easily separated from the physical means employed to accomplish it. All social frameworks involve rules, but differently. For example, a checker move is informed by rules of the game, most of which will be applied in any one complete playing through of the game. The physical manipulation of a checker, on the other hand, involves a framework informing small bodily movements. And this framework, if indeed it is possible to speak in terms of one framework, might well be manifest only partially during the playing of a game. So too, although the rules for checkers and the rules of vehicular traffic can be and are well enough explicated within the confines of a small book, there is a difference. The game of checkers incorporates an understanding of the governing purpose of the participants, whereas the traffic code does not establish where we are to travel or why we should want, but merely the restraints we are to observe in getting there. In sum, then, we tend to perceive events in terms of primary framework, and the type of framework we employ provides a way of describing the event to which it is applied. When the sun comes up, a natural event. When the blind is pulled down in order to avoid what has come up, a guided doing. When a coroner asks the cause of death, he wants an answer phrased in the natural schema of physiology. When he asks the manner of death, he wants a dramatically social answer, one that describes what is quite possibly part of an intent. The idea of a primary framework is then the first concept that is needed. I wish it were more satisfactory. For example, there is the embarrassing fact that during one moment, any one moment of an activity, an individual is likely to apply several frameworks. Gives an example. We waited till the rain stopped and then started the game again. Of course, sometimes a particular framework is chiefly relevant and provides a first answer to the question, what is it that's going on? The answer, an event or deed described within some primary framework. Then one can begin to worry about the microanalytic of what is meant by we, it, and here, and how the implied consensus is established. Now, a further consideration is necessary. When an X and a Y axis can be located as the framework within which to identify a given point, or a checkerboard brought to mind as a matrix within which to locate a move, the notion of a primary framework is clear enough. Although even here, there is the issue of the dependency of a particular framework upon our understanding of frameworks of that type. When one looks at some ordinary happening in daily life, say a passing greeting or a customer's request for the price of an article, an identification of the primary framework is, as already suggested, very considerably more problematic. Here, indeed, is where the writers in the tradition I am employing have quietly fallen down. To speak here of everyday life, or as Schutz does, of the world of wide awake practical reality, is merely to take a shot in the dark. As suggested, a multitude of frameworks may be involved, or none at all. To proceed, however, an operating fiction might be accepted, at least temporarily, namely that acts of daily living are understandable because of some primary framework or frameworks that informs them, and that getting at this schema will not be a trivial task, or hopefully an impossible one. In describing primary frameworks so far, I have limited attention to those that are assumed, explicitly or in effect, by the individual in deciding what it is that is going on, given, of course, his particular interests. The individual, it is true, can be, quote, wrong in his interpretations, that is, misguided, out of touch, inappropriate, and so forth. Quote, wrong interpretations will be considered throughout. Here I want only to mention the belief that in many cases the individual in our society is effective in his use of particular framework. The elements and processes he assumes in his reading of the activity often are ones that the activity itself manifests. And why not? Since social life itself is often organized as something that individuals will be able to understand and deal with. A correspondence or isomorphism is thus claimed between perception and the organization of what is perceived, in spite of the fact that there are likely to be many valid principles of organization that could, but don't, inform perception. And just as others in society find this an effective claim, so do I. He has a long footnote that I'll read. Some students would have it, of course, that the belief I express here is unnecessary and misplaced, and that one ought to restrict oneself totally to analyzing a subject's conception without drawing on the issue of their validity, except when this issue is itself treated as merely another matter to examine ethnographically. Else one confounds subject matter with the means of studying. Such a position introduces a famous problem of its own, the requirement that readers exempt the writer's generalization from the treatment he advocates for everyone else. And he has a footnote to his footnote. I believe writers should be indulged in this requirement since they often succeed in illuminating matters through this indulgence. More importantly, it can be argued that although all interpretive responses ought to be treated as a subject matter, some happen to provide useful beginnings of, not merely for, analysis. Complicated. Okay, end of footnote. Start of part two of this chapter. Taken altogether, the primary frameworks of a particular social group constitute a central element of its culture, especially insofar as understandings emerge concerning principal classes of schemata, the relations of these classes to one another, and the sum total of forces and agents that these interpretive designs acknowledge to be loose in the world. One must try to form an image of a group's framework of framework, its belief system, its cosmology, even though this is a domain that close students of contemporary social life have usually been happy to give over to others. And note that across a territory like the United States, there is an incomplete sharing of these cognitive resources. Persons otherwise quite similar in their beliefs may yet differ in regard to a few assumptions, such as the existence of second sight, divine intervention, and the like, in parentheses, belief in God and in the sacredness of his local representatives, seems to constitute currently one of the largest bases of dissent in our society concerning ultimate force. Tact ordinarily prevents social scientists from discussing the matter. Okay, start of part three. The notion of primary framework, unsatisfactory as it is, does allow one immediately to consider five distinctive matters and to appreciate something of their bearing on our overall understanding of the workings of the world. One, first, the astounding complex, he has in quote. An event occurs, or is made to occur, that leads observers to doubt their overall approach to event. For it seems that to account for the occurrence, new kinds of natural forces will have to be allowed, or new kinds of guiding capacity, the latter involving, perhaps, new kinds of active agent. Here are included what appear to be visitation, communications from outer space, religious healing mirror, sightings of monsters from the deep, levitation, horses that are mathematically inclined, fortune-telling, contacting the dead, and so forth. As suggested, these astonishing occurrences imply the existence of extraordinary natural forces and guidance capacity. For example, astrological influences, second sight, extrasensory perception, and so on. Believe it or not, books are available detailing events that are, quote, still unexplained. Occasionally, scientists themselves make news by giving what is defined as serious attention to ESP, UFOs, influences deriving from the phases of the moon and the like. Many private persons can call to mind at least one event which they themselves have never quite been able to account for reasonably. Yet in general, when an astounding event occurs, individuals in our society expect that a simple or natural explanation will soon be delivered, one that will clear up the mystery and restore them to the range of forces and events and agents that they are accustomed to, and to the line that they ordinarily draw between natural phenomena and guided doing. Certainly, individuals exhibit considerable resistance to changing their framework of framework. A public stir, or at least a ripple, is caused by any event that apparently cannot be managed within the traditional cosmology. An example from the press might be cited. from Colorado. An autopsy on a horse believed by its owners to have been killed by inhabitants of a flying saucer has revealed that its abdominal, brain, and spinal cavities were empty. The pathologist, a Denver specialist who wished to remain anonymous, said the absence of organs in the abdominal cavity was unexplainable, etc. And we expect a resolution as follows. Moscow. A Russian housewife, who startled the world 7 years ago with her claims of finger vision, has been exposed as a fraud, a Soviet newspaper said. Five scientists who tested Mrs. Rosa Kuleshova concluded that she had been peeking through holes in her blindfold, blah, blah, blah. Let me repeat. In our society, the very significant assumption is generally made that all events, without exception, can be contained and managed within the conventional system of beliefs. We tolerate the unexplained, but not the inexplicable. Two. Cosmological interest, in some ways the largest we can have, support a humble entertainment. The exhibition of stunts, that is, the maintenance of guidance and control by some willed agency under what are seen as nearly impossible conditions. Here is found the doings of jugglers, tightrope walkers, equestrians, surfers, trick skiers, knife throwers, high divers, blah, 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 and currently astronauts. These last having the greatest act of all, albeit one for which they must share credits with American technology. One might also conclude that stunts that individuals can learn to perform with their physiology, as when a function like blood pressure or pain response is brought under voluntary control. Note that animal acts play an important role in regard to stunting. Trained seals, sociable porpoises, dancing elephants, and acrobatic lions all exemplify the possibility of ordinary guided doings done by alien agents, thus drawing attention to the cosmological line drawn in our society between human agent and animal. So too, when animals are shown to have been pressed into doing the sort of utilitarian tasks that are felt to be the exclusive providence of man, as when a chimp causes deep consternation on the highway because her trainer has taught her to steer an open sports car while he attempts to be asleep in the next seat. Or a troop of chimps is employed by a farmer in Australia to help with the harvest. It might be added that some academic research is supported by the same interest, the object being to establish with precision just where the line ought to be drawn between animals and man in regard to capacity for guided doing. It is worth noting that both the astounding complex in the form of human freak and stunts are closely associated with circus sideshow. And if a social function of circus were to clarify for patrons what the ordering and limits of their basic frameworks are. Stunts also figure in vaudeville nightclubs, much now in the decline, as do the talents of trained dogs, acrobatic teams, jugglers, magicians, and, as will be considered later, mentalists. Whatever the views obtained from such exhibits, it is clear that interest in cosmologically grounded issues is an everyday concern of the layman, and by no means restricted to laboratory and field research. 3. Consider now, quote, muffings, namely, occasions when the body or some other object assumed to be under assured guidance unexpectedly breaks free, deviates from course, or otherwise slips from control, becoming totally subject, not merely conditioned by, natural forces, with consequent disruption of orderly life. Thus, flubs, goofs, and gaffes. The limiting case would be where no blame whatsoever attached, as when an earthquake is given full responsibility for a person's having spilled a cup of tea. The body here retains its capacity as a natural causal force, but not as an intentioned social one. An example might be cited. 5 persons were injured, 2 seriously, yesterday when a car went out of control and ran them down on a crowded Haight-Ashbury sidewalk. The driver of the car, 23-year-old Ed Heiss of 615 Cole Street, was taken in a near hysterical condition to Park Station, where he was booked on charges of carrying a concealed weapon and suspicion of possessing dangerous drugs. "I couldn't stop the car," he cried. "There were people all over. 4, 6, 8 people. But, oh God, it wasn't my fault." Witnesses said the car was westbound on Haight Street just past the Masonic Avenue intersection when it jumped the curb, plowed into the windows of the New Light supermarket, and swept 50 feet further down the sidewalk. "I didn't mean to hurt them," he sobbed, "but they were all around me, on my left, right, all around." Note, a stunt occurs when we might well expect and even condone a loss of control. A muffing, when exemplary effort is not felt to be needed to maintain control. But nonetheless, control is lost. He has a footnote about learning to do something, that it involves a period of frequent muffing, and performance will occasionally involve muffings on the part of the fully
confident. And he gives you.
The apparent locus of control exerted in guiding an act provides a perspective on failures to control, and indeed a suggestion of how we distinguish among types of doing. Some acts are seen as being implemented by the limbs alone, as when we rub an eye, light a match, tie a shoe, balance a tray. Some are seen as located in an extension of limbs, as in driving a car, or raking a lawn, or turning a screwdriver. Finally, there are doings which seem to begin with the body or an extension of it and end up guiding something that is palpably separated from the initial control, as when a golf ball, a tobacco quid, or a missile ends up where it was aimed. Early socialization presumably assures competence in the first. Adult socialization, specifically job training, competence in the other two. Observe that one of the consequences of this learning program is the transformation of the world into a place that is appreciably governed by and understandable in terms of social framework. Indeed, all adults in urban community may move about through months of their days without once finding themselves out of control of their bodies or unprepared for the impingement of the environment, the whole of the natural world having been subjugated by public and private means of control. In any case, attention is directed anew to sports such as skating, skiing, surfing, and riding, which allow youths and adults to reaccomplish guided control of their bodies through uneasily managed extensions, a recapitulation of early achievement results accompanied as of old by many muffing, but now in a special context, play. A case of counterphobia for the leisure class. To be noted, too, is the obvious appeal of the Laurel and Hardy type of comedy, which presents incompetence and bungling on a massive scale, and the vertigo rides at fun fairs, which allow individuals to lose control of themselves in carefully controlled circumstances. Number 4. Next to consider is fortuitousness, meaning here that a significant event can come to be seen as incidentally produced. An individual, properly guided his doings, meets with natural workings of the world in a way that he could not have expected to anticipate, with consequential results. Or two or more unconnected and mutually unoriented individuals, each properly guiding his own doing, jointly bring about an unanticipated event that is significant. And these actors have this effect even though their contributed doings remain fully under control. We speak here of happenstance, coincidence, good and bad luck, accident, and so forth. Because no responsibility is imputed, one has something like a natural framework, except that the ingredients upon which the natural forces operate are here socially guided doing. Note 2, fortuitous consequences may be felt to be desirable or undesirable. The notion of fortuitous connection is obviously delicate, as though those who put it forward as an account had some doubts about using so pat a solution, or were concerned about another might have these doubts. This precariousness becomes especially evident when a particular kind of happenstance occurs a second or third time to the same object or individual or category of individual. So too, meaningfulness will be hard to avoid when the beneficiary or victim of the fortuitousness is in a prominent class of persons containing only one member. The concepts of muffings and fortuitousness have considerable cosmological significance. Given our belief that the world can be totally perceived in terms of either natural events or guided doings, and that every event can be comfortably lodged in one or the other category, it becomes apparent that a means must be at hand to deal with slippage and looseness. The cultural notions of muffing and fortuitousness serve in this way, enabling the citizenry to come to terms with events that would otherwise be an embarrassment to its system of analysis. 5. The final matter to consider bears upon the segregation issue expressed in tension and joking. As will be argued throughout, individuals can rarely fully constitute what they see in accordance with this framework, with the framework that officially applies. But there is a limit to this capacity. Individuals can rather fully constitute what they see in accordance with the framework that officially applies, but there's a limit to this capacity. Certain effects carry over from one perspective in which events could easily be seen to a radically different one, the latter, the one which officially applied. The best documented case, perhaps, is the slow development of the easy right of medical people to approach the human naked body with a natural instead of a social perspective. Thus, it was only at the end of the 18th century in Britain that childbirth could benefit from an obstetric examination, an undarkened operating room, and delivery, if a male physician was to do it, unencumbered by its having to be performed undercover. The gynecological examination is even today a matter of some concern, special effort being taken to infuse the procedure with terms and actions that keep sexual readings in check. Another example is the difficulty faced by those who would promote the practice of rescue breathing. Mouth-to-mouth contact apparently cannot easily be dissociated from its ritual implication. Similarly, we manage to let orthopedists and shoe salesmen touch our feet, but first we make sure to clean what might ritually contaminate. Or consider the sensei, the instructor at karate, who, when his students take up a proper position, ordinarily can touch crucial points of their bodies instrumentally, as might a physician, to determine directly whether the appropriate tension is present, etc., etc. Part 4. One general point should be stressed. The primary perspectives, natural and social, available to members of a society such as ours affect more than merely the participants in an activity. Bystanders who merely look are deeply involved too. It seems that we can hardly glance at anything without applying a primary framework, thereby forming conjectures as to what occurred before, and expectations of what is likely to happen now. A readiness merely to glance at something and then to shift attention to other things apparently is not produced solely by a lack of concern. Glancing itself seems to be made possible by the quick confirmation that viewers can attain, thus ensuring that anticipated perspectives apply. For surely we have as an important motivational relevance the discovery of the motivational relevance of the event for the other persons present. Mere perceiving, then, is much more active penetration of the world than at first might be thought. Bergson approaches this argument in his fine essay, Laugh, quote, "Any arrangement of acts and events is comic, which gives us, in a single combination, the illusion of life and the distinct impression of a mechanical arrangement," and also rigidity, automatism, absent-mindedness, and unsociability are all inextricably intertwined, and all serve as ingredients to the making up of the comic in character. And another, "We laugh every time a person gives us the impression of being a thing," end quote. In pointing out that individuals often laugh when confronted by a person who does not sustain in every way an image of human guidedness, Bergson only fails to go on and draw the implied conclusion, namely that if individuals are ready to laugh during occurrences of ineffectively guided behavior, then all along they apparently must have been fully assessing the conformance of the normally behaved, finding it to be no laughing matter. In sum, observers actively project their frames of reference into their world immediately around them, and one fails to see they're doing so only because events ordinarily confirm these projections, causing the assumptions to disappear into the smooth flow of activity. Thus, a properly dressed woman who closely examines the frame of a mirror on sale at an auction, and then stands back to check on the trueness of the mirror's reflection, can well be seen by others present as someone who hasn't really been seen. But if she uses the mirror to adjust her hat, then others present can become aware that only a certain sort of looking had all along been what was expected, and that the object on the wall was not so much a mirror as a mirror for sale. And this experience can be reversed should she appraisingly examine a mirror in a dressing room instead of examining herself in a mirror. Is this long footnote that's probably relevant? I do not mean to imply that no stable meaning is built socially into artifact, merely that circumstances can enforce an additional meaning. Cannon shells, 5-gallon jars, and bits of disused plumbing can be transformed from utilitarian goods into decorative lamps, but their value as the latter depends on their never quite ceasing to be the former. At best, the result is not a lamp, but an interesting one. In fact, a certain amount of sport can be found in subordinating an official use to an irrelevantly alien one, as when pranksters managed to play push-button phones for tune, not numbers, a possibility opened up by the fact that each button, when pushed, produces its own distinct tone. Here again, I argue that the meaning of an object or act is a product of social definition, and that this definition emerges from the object's role in the society at large, which role then becomes for smaller circles a given, something that can be modified but not totally recreated. The meaning of an object, no doubt, is generated through its use, pragmatists say, but ordinarily not by particular users. In brief, all things used for hammering in nails are not hammered. End of chapter 2.